Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome to the Salieri Report a man who needs no introduction here. One of my favorite people on the whole planet, John Rappaport. I always say that when nothing else, we'll back up the walls. John Rappaport's fierce intellect always does. I'm known to listen to my favorite John Rappaport audios when I'm sitting in the airport watching CNN. So I'm watching CNN lie to everybody, and I listen to John Rappaport and get the real deal. So, John, it's always a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming in on the Salieri Report.
It's great to be here, as always.
Well, I did something the other night that I never do this, but I forget what it was, but I got on the internet and was surfing. I was in Zurich and was surfing and seeing sort of what was going on in the United States, not being there. And the coverage of the Pope was so infuriating. I finally said, I have to take a pain pill. I have to drug myself to go to sleep. And anyway, but the next day I read your latest piece on the Pope and calmed down. So we're going to talk today about changing our mind, but I think it's a good place to dive in and just talk about what's been going on in this September, because it leads us right into the fact that there's tremendous power in changing our mind, and we clearly haven't done it yet. Or we haven't hit a critical mass of people who've done it. So talk to us about the last 30 days. What's on your mind?
Well, certainly, you know, the visit of the Pope and the campaign season has kicked off, of course, for the presidency. I think it's just, you know, I guess if I had to put it in a nutshell, it would be the towering number of lies that are just cascading everywhere, it seems to be. And we have the UN trying to bolster its agenda of managing the world, and they're now claiming a goal of eradicating poverty on the planet in 15 years. That would only include making, I don't know, somewhere around 6 billion people suddenly rise above the poverty line. So it's kind of throwing up huge amounts of stuff on the wall and seeing what's going to stick to try to convince the public that, yes, we're all heading in a good direction and this is all very important and don't get worried, and the huge migration of populations everywhere is really a great thing and it's to be expected, and calm down. And I just see it as, I think you put it to me in an email, which is, we have, if anything, too much information, and people are dissociating from it, so that makes it very hard for people to find out what's going on.
Right. Right. Well, there's clearly, you see an acceleration of events. There was a lot scheduled for this September. I was very concerned because the federal budget was left open. I was very concerned that the doings at the UN and the Pope's visit would cause something to spin out of those different assemblies and plop into the budget. Now, we haven't seen the final budget. We don't know what is entailed, but it doesn't, as of yet, there's no grand scheme that's been announced that's flipping into the budget. So I feel a little bit relieved about that. I have been very shocked at the response to both the campaign and the Pope's visit. It's as though we have a complete disassociation from what those institutions have done in the past, as though a different face who says different things matters. And that's what I can't, you know, this happens to me during every presidential campaign. In other words, why does anybody care what these people say? You know, we're talking about who's going to get the pork and running a machine, and the machine's not going to change.
Yeah, this is big to me. I go back all the way to 1980, I think, when a friend of mine who was as apolitical as anybody I had ever known suddenly piped up and said, this election is going to make all the difference in the future of the world, and you've got to vote against Reagan and this, that, and the other thing. And every election since then, it's the same rhetoric. People are saying, well, doesn't matter what you think, doesn't matter what you believe, but you've got to really join the parade and decide which one of these candidates is better because we're on the brink of catastrophe, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And every time, enormous numbers of people seem to buy in for one reason or another to the idea that it's going to be different depending on whom we elect. And as you say, the machine just keeps rolling. So wake up.
Well, and the machine is doing some pretty, if you look at what the machine is doing behind the scenes, it's doing some pretty, I mean, we literally have become guinea pigs in one of the greatest scientific experiments of all time. So, you know, if you look at what the machine's up to, it's some pretty scary stuff. And whatever is going to, you know, one of the things that would be interesting in the campaign is having an honest conversation about the scary stuff that's really going on. I don't know if you saw it, but during the debates, we had a moment when there was an honest description of what vaccines do to cause autism, which I thought it was like, wow, something slipped through. I don't know if you saw it or not.
No, I didn't.
Oh, it was pretty amazing. Trump described how he had an employee who had a perfect child, and they went and got a series of vaccines, and
the child had
a fever and got real sick and then became autistic, and basically said, you know, on prime TV, vaccines cause autism. I thought, whoa, you know,
yeah.
something real popped up.
Yeah, and he's made other statements to that effect in the past. And
he's backpedaled enormously since then.
Offhanded way. Like, of course, everybody knows what's really going on. Well, that's one of the things the machine is very busily doing behind the scenes is hyping up all of the pro-vaccine, you know, monstrosity for everybody, and trying to convince them that their children will just fall down and die in the street if they don't get vaccinated for, you know, if they don't have 50 or 60 shots by the time they're 5 years old. It's absolutely horrendous. I mean, it's biological chemical warfare being touted as medical prevention. So, yes.
Well, why? So the thing that has always been hard for me to fathom during these periods of, you know, major marketing efforts by the leadership, whether it's the campaigns or, you know, something like the Pope's visit. Why is it we have, so let's pick on the Catholic Church for a second. We have an institution that is, you know, has been significantly, or a lot of transparency has been brought to certain aspects of the things, the illegal activities that's engaged in. We haven't had a full, clear outing of the, what I would call the business and investment model. But, you know, what we've seen is an institution that was wanting the, what was 30 years ago, the predominant control file network, you know, among other things, using sex slaves to, you know, to not only get its control files, but to basically provide personnel benefits. And it combined it with 2,000 years of, you know, tax-free money management, as well as diplomatic immunity by many of the people, you know, representing the Vatican and Vatican City. And so you have this extraordinary business and investment model. And, you know, and if you look at what what it's done and how it's done and how it's made money doing this, there seems to be a complete inability to associate it with all the things about governance on planet Earth that no one likes. And so a new guy comes along, a new face, and suddenly everybody likes him as though something's changed. And he walks around and proceeds to say, you know, all sorts of nice sounding things, but doesn't propose any systemic change to, you know, here's the church's money, here's what we're going to do with the money, here's how we're going to make restitution. I mean, the way to end poverty is to stop doing the things that cause poverty.
That's right.
So, right. So we're, you know, he's talked about some things that would stop poverty, but if you look at the money, the, if you take the full umbrella of the Catholic Church, all its institutions and all of its endowments, if he said, okay, we're going to take all that money and we're just going to stop investing in any company that we think contributes to warfare, that would be a very different matter. But he isn't saying that. He's saying, let's, you know, stop arms trading. But he's not saying we're going to disinvest in arms traders.
No.
It's kind of a multiple personality disorder, which is mirrored back in the by the entire society. You know, there's... you know, I keep having people tell me, oh, you know, the Pope is wonderful. Well, no, he's not wonderful. He's out there, you know, basically rebranding an institution that is doing all these things. And, you know, and so they can keep on doing it. And he's not touching the real train tracks.
Exactly.
But what I don't understand is...
I think one of the things that's happening there is that huge numbers of people... continue to be suckered into high-flying, empty rhetoric and generalities, no matter where it comes from, especially when it comes from government or, you know, an organized, gigantic entity like the Vatican. You know, these people have power, and they're saying the right things. Therefore, everything is going to be better because... No, it's not going to be better, but you have to be able to discern the difference between somebody who is going to do something concrete and someone who is just spouting high-flying generalities that mean nothing because they're, you know, they burn up like paper the second after they're enunciated. So what difference does it make? And yet... you have enormous numbers of people that are still entrained to respond to that kind of language. And I think one of the things that's going on, and there are many, but one of the things is that people are still not educated well enough through their own efforts or through, you know, wherever they went to school to understand the difference between somebody who is saying, quote, the right things, and somebody who actually means to take specific action. I mean, if the Pope, for example, wanted to eliminate poverty, as he keeps saying, well, I mean, what's the sensible way to do that? Instead of saying, we're going to change the world all at once so that we eliminate, you know, 6 billion people who can't enter the global marketplace in 15 years, we're going to do this. How about saying, we're going to take one country in Africa, we're going to clean up the water supplies, we're going to somehow return stolen land, agricultural land, to the people so they can grow their own food, and we're going to eliminate hideous overcrowding in the cities. Let's just start with that. You know, show me something, in other words. Let's see you do something. But that does not seem to be on the public's radar, that that would be a significant way to talk and to take action. Instead, people continue to look to the same kind of empty promises that they got when Obama was running for president the first time. It's something that can make your blood boil if you can't stand back from it and understand that people's minds are just not capable of making discernments and distinctions.
So you're saying people aren't capable of telling the difference between actions and words?
Yeah, exactly. That's right. They don't know the difference. And it's because they've seen, for one thing, they've seen so little action that actually succeeds. So they don't have that as a model. They can't say, well, look, why doesn't the Pope talk about Uganda? Because, you know, we already solved this problem in Guinea. Remember that 2 years ago? We wiped out all the contaminated water. And then there was that thing in South America in Sao Paulo where, you know, we eliminated these horrendous chemicals, dumps, and this, because those things never happened. Nothing happened in Sao Paulo. Nothing happened in Guinea. Nothing happened anywhere that you could point to as a specific success based on action that would cure a problem. Therefore, when somebody comes along with this kind of rhetoric, people can't tell the difference between the talk and the action because they haven't seen any positive examples of action. They don't know what that
is. It's really amazing in community development in America.
You could get tens of millions of dollars for studies, but you couldn't get any money to do something that would really work.
Exactly. That's what I'm talking about.
Right.
It's
right.
The same
it
deal.
Was... Right.
The exact same deal. There's a guy up in L.A. now who is seems to be doing quite a tremendous amount in South Central Los Angeles with building urban gardens and farms and growing food, really nutritious, clean food that the residents themselves grow, you know, a tremendous project. And there are the other similar projects in inner cities, but there should be thousands of them. And with a tiny amount, I mean a minuscule amount of the maybe $2 trillion that's been poured into the war on poverty in inner cities since 1966, you could have 10,000 of these urban farms in inner cities by now where you actually do something and people would have food and they would be getting healthier. But no, you can't get any government money for that. You can only, as you say, get money to study the problem and report on it and blah, blah, blah. Same with the World Health Organization. They appoint task force after task force to study the problems of health in the third world, and they come up with the same answers, clean up the water supplies, you know, eliminate overcrowding and lack of basic sanitation, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and nobody does anything.
Right. Right. And the now let me just play the devil's advocate here, because I think, you know, what I go back to my story, the red button, about, you know, out of 100 people, only one would push the red button if it stopped narcotics trafficking in their neighborhood because they didn't want to see the financial system collapse. And, you know, and they felt that we were deeply dependent on sort of cash flows of illegal or unethical activities. So if you look at how the current model in the United States works, you know, much of the economy works off the federal budget, and much of the federal budget works off of the fact that the dollar is the reserve currency. So you have a very powerful machinery globally that's using force to cause a subsidy to flow, which until relatively recent, you know, almost everybody in America was the beneficiary of that. So to what extent is everyone thinking, you know, I want my check, but I want to feel good about myself? And so they want the leadership to go get their check, but then they want the leadership, you know, to make us out to be nice people so they can feel good about themselves and enjoy the money they get in the check.
Yeah, I mean, the check is the all-important thing, no question about it. But if the check is ultimately and covertly supporting the same old machine that keeps on rolling, which it is, making more people dependent all the time, making communities sink into lower and lower social, political, economic levels, then it doesn't work. It doesn't
right.
work. but you have to be
right. But we're all financially dependent on our own debasement.
Yeah, if that's the way the machine works, then you're only going to get a certain number of individuals at first who can A, see through that, and B, do something else that still allows them to make money, but something good.
Well, the big joke is what I discovered in the 90s. What I discovered was that if you re-engineered the government money to a positive return on investment, there was plenty of money. That you could get a significantly better optimization and performance with the economy. You know, there was a lot more money to go around. It didn't have to be like this. And that's before I knew the power of new technology. So if you look at the underlying cash flows, if we re-optimized, it doesn't have to be. In other words, you're doing great harm to the economy from top-down control. So if you look at the lies, if you look at the, you know, the failure to bring transparency to all sorts of issues, if you look at the money spent on control, I had one when we built a data servicing company in the inner city because we realized with welfare reform, you can teleport jobs into all these areas and get people working and they can become taxpayers and the economies can thrive and the value of the real estate can go up, all of that stuff. We did an analysis of the expected growth in data servicing demands. And what we realized was the U.S. government was planning on spending, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars collecting and managing data on all of us. It was pretty frightening when we realized what was being planned. And that was before even fathoming what the NSA was going to do. So, it's quite extraordinary the extent to which we're paying government money to basically build giant databases on everyone and then not share the data. You know, it truly is a one-way mirror. Well, how do we help people change their mind? Because
We've been touching a bit on it already, and that is to see, put it this way, when I see people living their lives, one of the things I see is space, their space, the space of their minds, the space of their physical living space, workspace, and how they conceive of that, you know, and what they populate that space with. In the same way that you could, and I often resort to these metaphors, you know, you have a painter before a very large blank canvas. Well, he looks at that canvas as space. What am I going to put in it? What am I going to do with it? How am I going to populate it? And most people, unfortunately, are not aware that space is involved in their mind and the way they see things and how they want things to be. So it doesn't appear that there's any escape route. It doesn't appear that there's anything that they can do. Because if they change their minds, what difference would that make? It doesn't seem like that would have an effect. Whereas they would prefer to have, you know, metaphorically speaking, a kind of a white picket fence around their mental conception of their own lives and just keep things the way they are inside that fence. And as long as that's the case, they're never going to change their mind in any effective way. It's never going to happen. So to me, the first thing that certainly helps a person is to understand that they do have some conception of what their own life is. And if they penetrate to discover what that is, it opens up the possibility of change, of, oh, well, so I'm participating in my own concept of what my life is and my thoughts about my life, and therefore I can change all of that. And sometimes it takes a crisis, and nothing else will do, where a person feels desperate for one reason or another, and then they are kind of feeling that they're forced into making a new beginning, sometimes it won't work unless that happens. So that's kind of where I would start with this whole subject.
So really, what we're talking about is the ability to create a vision of your life and build your own pathway.
Yes. And some people are so immersed in their present vision of what their life is that they don't even recognize that it is a vision or that they have anything to do with it. So that becomes a major obstruction. But yes, if a person can have a vision of what they want their life to be, then that's the prelude to potentially enormous change.
Well, I think one of the reasons that I was eager to get out of the States for a while. It's funny, I talked to someone today in China, and they had just returned to China from the United States, and they said, "Oh, I'm so glad to be out of the United States. It's so positive here. You know, everybody's doing and going and making and building, and the United States is so negative." And she said, "Everything is about fear. And it's just the whole environment is so negative." And I don't know if it was just me and what I do, John, but for the last couple months, I'm constantly trying to persuade clients and subscribers from falling prey to just an endless amount of fear porn, all coming from people, most of them in the financial area, who refuse to deal with the real deal. It's almost like they're stuck in a negative loop because they can't talk about what's really going on, and they can't look at the unanswered questions of, you know, who's really in charge and what's really going on. They're kind of stuck in this closed negative loop.
I would say that's absolutely right. And also, it's the fear thing speaks to the fact that people don't have their own vision of what they want their life to be, because if they did, that would immediately diminish the fear. The fear is at its height when you feel paralyzed. Well, I don't know what to do. What should I decide? How is it going with my money, my life, my economics, my family, my this, my that? In the absence of a vision of what you want it to be, you're a sitting duck, like a target for all the slings and arrows that are being sent your way. Fear this, fear that, you worry about this, watch out for that. That's how it takes hold. And people, if they are just simply trying to ward off one by one all the arrows of fear, it's never going to happen. There's new ones coming all the time as part of the program. In order to diminish all of that at once, a person has to have a vision. Well, what do I really want? What do I want to see in my future? What do I want to create in my future? How do I want it to be for myself, my family, et cetera, et cetera? You know, that's the deep creative impulse. And once that gets fleshed out, then the person looks around and says, yeah, I can see how much fear is being promoted now. I didn't realize that before. Before, I was just getting hit by the arrows. But now, I can see that, you know, this is a conscious thing that's being done all the time to rev up the fear.
Well, I don't know. I call a lot of them adult fairy tales. And they were really, you know, the predominance of them and people taking them seriously. And I think they're, I'm seeing a loss of time coming from attention to whether it's fear porn and adult fairy tales or, you know, the media spectacles, whether it's the campaign or the Pope. you know, I'm seeing people lose enormous amounts of time that could be used in creating the life we want to live. That's precious time. We're never going to get that time back.
How do we grab that time and put it?
Well, I think you're right. You know, I have one associate who always says, well, they need a picture of where they're going. And she's very big on people needing pictures. And I finally realized, oh, yeah, you know, she's absolutely right. Because if you have a picture you're attracted to, then you don't have time for this crazy stuff.
That's right. Absolutely. Because you're inspired. You're inspired to make that picture turn into a reality, you know. And that's kind of the... It's like a seesaw, you know, you can be on one side or the other. If there isn't a picture or a vision, then, you know, you're sitting at the low end of the seesaw and all these arrows are coming in. But you want to get to the other side where you're up top, and that side is where you are putting your time and energy and effort into making this picture come true.
Right. So changing your mind is really about taking the focus of your mind and focusing it on building that picture of what you want.
Yes. And here's another angle on this. Many people feel a lack of confidence about doing that because they've never done it before, because no one has taught them or said that it's important to do. They look in their memories and they don't find any period of time where parents, teachers, coworkers, friends, family, whoever, were saying to them, well, what do you really want? Instead, they see a whole bunch of other things. So when you say that to them, look, you have to have a vision of what you really want. For a lot of people, that sounds alien. Like, are you from another planet? Where did you get that idea from? You know, and they have to shift gears and begin to understand, well, look, it's your life. It's your future. Don't you think that you should be participating in it? And if you are participating in it or you want to, don't you think you should decide the terms of that participation? And gradually what you lead up to again is, well, what is your vision of the kind of future that you want? What is that? Flesh it out. Make notes. Start writing. Draw pictures. Whatever it takes to bring it all back home to yourself where it really is in the first place. But people are not familiar with that process. Many people are not confident that they would be able to do that because, unlike a lot of other repetitious things they do in their life, they don't have any experience with that. So they say, well, this must be foreign, alien. I'd rather rely on the tried and the true. You know, I would compare it to when people suddenly change the way they eat. You know, they bring in enough information to finally decide there's something wrong with the way I'm eating and the way I've been eating all my life. It's not good. I like the food, but the effects are bad. I can see that now. There's no question about it. What am I going to do? Well, what they have to do is to have a vision of the way that they should be eating or the way they want to be eating. And many people have made that break where they say, I don't care how uncomfortable this might make me feel radically changing the way I eat. I'm going to do it because this, what I've got now, is not working. It's bad. I'm going downhill and I can see it and I can feel it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they make that move, even though they've never done anything like that before in their lives because they feel like they're in a crisis, desperation time. So they summon up the adrenaline, the energy, and all of that, and they strike out in a new direction. Well, just magnify or extend that out to the idea of your entire future. It's the same deal. The way things have been going, it's not working. It's working up to a point, but you can see
it's not working.
There's a deterioration that's setting in quickly or slowly, and something's got to change.
I have to tell you a story about Waco. Remember Waco? Okay, so a fellow named Mike, I think his name was Michael Murphy, sat down and made a series of documentaries on Waco that really outed the true story of what had happened. And, you know, basically you'd had a group of adults and kids murdered in cold blood by the federal government. And on, I think it was his second documentary, he rented Union Station. And he had three showings. First was to people in the, you know, congressional staff and congressmen in the Hill. And then the second was, I think so, it's like 200 people from Congress. And then the second was 200 people from the administration. And then the third was 200 people from the Washington Press Corps. And I was there with one of the people from the Washington Press Corps. It was an amazing documentary. Amazing. And, you know, it just really nailed a lot of the hidden aspects of the story. And the one reporter turned to me and said, well, you're never going to stop this story now. And then nothing happened. Nothing happened. It was amazing. Well, a couple years later, finally, enough traction had happened and there was more squabbling with some of the players in the involved in the Waco incident. And finally, the key witness who had done the testing, which proved a lot of sort of the true story, was assassinated. Forget what the name of the senator from St. Louis was. There was a Danforth was called to do a commission. Well, finally, the whole thing erupted into sort of a political moment when Janet Reno got on TV, took full responsibility and said, it's my fault, and gave a presentation of what had happened, which was complete lie. And I'll never forget, I was down in Florida, and she came on the TV to do it. And John, I watched her. And when I tell you, I never seen a liar who was as good as that.
Hmm.
And, you know, you almost said, is she mind controlled? Is she a robot? You know, this is an amazing, it was the most amazing theatrical performance I'd ever seen. When I tell you, the woman was so believable, even I knowing, you know, I've been to the Waco, I've been to the place, I've been there, I've, you know, I know a lot about that situation. And I'm watching Janet Reno, and I got to tell you, all I could say was my hat was off to the woman. I said, that is the best lie and the best liar I have ever seen. And I think, you know, I think to a certain extent, our entire society is watching, you know, really excellently well done lies, absolutely well done lies. And, you know, we all have to get to the point to change your mind. You have to face the reality that what is going on is that bad and that weird. I mean, what is going on is really weird. And a lot of the cranky people who are going around in circles refuse to face or talk about, you know, the really weird stuff. You and I have made a lifetime habit of talking about the really weird stuff, which is why, you know, we get occasionally cranky, but we don't spend our lives cranky. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And I think if you're willing to look into the truth and say, I don't know. So now I want to tell you another story after my Janet Reno part. And that is, you know, I'm a great lover of a book called Political Ponerology. And there's a review of it up at Salir. I don't know if you've read it or not, but it's by a Polish psychologist who claimed to have lived through Stalin and then, or lived through Hitler and then gone into Stalin. And he and his colleagues got together and decided to do a lifetime study of psychopathy as it works through political process. And he claims that where they came out was basically that 5% of the population is incapable of having empathy. They're basically psychopaths, and they're fantastic at organizing and getting together and, you know, and basically killing everyone else. Now, maybe they're aliens, maybe they're satanic worshipers, you know, who knows? But once the rest of the population cannot fathom that there are that many psychopaths in that many positions of power, and once they could fathom that they were dealing with a percentage of the population, whether because of what they were implementing or what they were in their character, once they could fathom that they were psychopaths and had no empathy, their neuroses immediately reduced radically, and they started coming up with ways of dealing with the situation that were fundamentally effective and a good use of their time. So they went from being dependent neurotics to basically intelligent adults effectively manipulating their circumstance in intelligent ways.
Well, that's pretty amazing.
I think to change your mind, you need to understand that you're dealing with something which is that alien. So I've always said, it doesn't matter whether aliens exist or not. You need to assume that they do.
Yeah, I agree. That's right. You would, and you sort of think wrongly that most people would be able to get with this and understand this, you know, but they don't. They don't, because
it's a John. It's a big hump to get over.
I'll tell you why. The hardest thing that I ever had to do is look in the mirror and say, you know, I'm the patsy. And I've seen that all my life. I've seen guys who've gone along and, you know, they all think, everybody thinks they're in with the in club until they get thrown out or until they get retired or they get benched or whatever. They turn 65 and they realize, you ab and ad, baby. You know, you got rolled. You were the patsy. You thought you were the predator, but no, you were the prey. And now you know. And that's the hardest thing to do is look in the mirror and say, you know, I've let myself get played. I'm the patsy. It's hard. And I think there are a lot of people who'd rather go around in a cranky place than face that. Because to break out and break into a free, inspired life, you have to face the fact that you're the patsy.
Sure. I agree. Here's something. From an early point in my life, and I have many friends about this, about whom I could say the same thing. For some reason, I'm not sure why, but we always kind of looked at things in a theatrical way. People are playing roles, right?
Right.
There's the role of the teacher, and there's the role of the good student and the bad student, and, you know, and there's the role of the parent, and then there's different kinds of parents, and you meet parents of your friends who are playing it all different. Hi, how you doing? Oh, it's great to see you. You know, come on in, have some ice cream, whatever. And then somebody else, you know, who's cold and distant. And after a while, it became obvious that the world is, in fact, this giant stage, and people are playing all kinds of roles, including the politicians, of course, and the corporate PR people, and, you know, everybody. And having seen that, it becomes much easier to realize that there are psychopathic liars and, you know, people who are just doing everything they can to control what's around them and so forth and so on, because you see this theatrical component. And I think that's a big deal in people changing their minds about their lives and right. What they're going to do with it. To me, if I could do one thing with the educational system overnight, it would be that from the beginning, everybody participates in theater. You have little skits and sketches and plays, and you're acting this role and that role and this role and that role. And after a while, you begin to see, well, you know, there's a lot of ways to play this. And you begin to see people in the so-called real world, you know, the lawyers, right. The doctors. You go into the doctor's office and you say, wow, this is a pretty interesting stage set they've got here. I sit in the waiting room, the magazines, and then they get me in a little room, and I've got this ridiculous little thing on. I'm naked underneath. It's cold in here. I'm sitting on a table, and then he comes in and tells me the, you know, what the story is, and I'm supposed to accept it. This is, you know, it's theater that's happening here. And to be able to get the flow of that and feel it and see it and understand it makes change a whole lot easier. People are committed to their roles in life, and then they ask people like you and me, well, how can I change? Well, wait a minute. What are you already committed to? Do you have a role that you're playing in life that you're solidly committed to for the last 30 years? I mean, this is an imaginary conversation, but suppose they said, well, yeah, I guess so. Okay, so what's that role? Describe it for me. Flesh it out. How do you work that thing every day? What do you do? How do you play that part in life? And if you could bring that and lay it on the table so that everybody can see it, then you say, well, you see, if you really want to change your life and you're upset about this and fearful about that, you've got to look at that role you've been playing, because if you keep that role, you're never going to change anything. Do you? Does that make sense to you now? And they would say, yeah, I see that. You say, okay, well, look, there's a lot of roles that you can choose. You can make them up. You don't have to accept anything. You can invent a role for yourself. Now they say, well, if I could do that, I could change anything. Yeah, that's right. You could. And you don't have to make it so bizarre and crazy that everybody's going to think you're nuts. It's just that you decide, you know, it's the theatrical part of life. It's being able to see, oh, well, this guy's completely full of it, and that spokesman is just lying through his teeth. I mean, look at him. You know, he's playing that part to the hilt. That's what they do.
So let me talk now about money, because one of the things, if we're going to change things, we're going to have to change how the money works. And if you look at, for the last, since 1980, interest rates have been coming down, 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 and governments have been issuing more and more debt. And the way we papered over our political differences is we just said, okay, give everybody money.
Right.
So 10 guys want to do 10 things, and rather than agree on what's the most efficient thing to do or what's the best use of our money, we'll just give them all money. So everybody gets money, and that solves a lot of the fights. And then, you know, the money started to get tighter and tighter. And so they said, okay, well, let's, you know, let's steal the money from, let's, you know, cut off the money to the guys below this income group. And then we'll just, you know, give everybody a month above this, you know, we'll give everything to the 1%. But ultimately the game keeps, you know, the pie keeps shrinking when you play it this way. So an enormous amount of money in the U.S. goes through the U.S. federal budget. So whether we're paying taxes or they're borrowing money, it's flowing around and it's engineering a lot of things. And as long as that money, you know, and then on top of that, of course, a lot of us are tithing, let's say we're tithing 5 to 10% of our income into all sorts of religious and charity foundations. So between those tax and bond flows and the, you know, the charity money, that's a huge chunk of change. And we can talk platitudes all day long about how we want to do this and want to do that, but if we don't change how that money works, nothing's going to change.
Well, certainly if we don't change the way we deal with money, I mean, I understand that the whole system is rigged. But at the same time, if that were the only out, the only escape route, if a person said there's nothing I can do to change my life until the entire money system is changed, then that person would be waiting around in a, you know, bus terminal for the rest of their life, and the bus would never show up.
Right. But imagine if everybody just said, I'll change what I can in my own money.
It'd
be quite amazing.
That would be it would be quite amazing. It would be quite amazing.
Can you imagine if every person and institution tomorrow called up Goldman Sachs and said, you know, you guys are pond scum. I'm pulling my account.
I keep waiting for that to happen. For some reason, it never does. The same with the stock market. You know, I keep hearing this, it's going up, it's going down, people investing in these stocks and those stocks and blah, 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 blah. And I keep thinking, gee, why don't they just all pull their money out, you know, and let the whole
thing. I'm one of the believers in it's not perfect, but the stock market, because I think there are a lot of good entrepreneurs and a lot of good companies. So I want to be able to have a stock market. So I'm kind of a pro equity kind of person. But the reality is, you know, increasingly, if you look at how it's operated in a way that is, you know, it's not good savers and good entrepreneurs getting together. And that's dangerous, because without believing in each other and without supporting each other, building the kind of economy we want to have, you know, that's really when it stops. And that's been my big thing, which is, you know, you ought to care about where your money is and where it's going, and you ought to shift it accordingly. And if you did, it would make a huge difference. You know, one of the things I wrote in my piece on the encyclical is I've watched all sorts of Catholic institutions. I don't want to name names or point fingers, but all sorts of Catholic institutions where the Catholics involved can't get basic reports on where their principal is invested and can't get a commitment to socially responsible investing of any particular kind. You know, it's quite remarkable. And so the Pope is off saying one thing when in fact what's going on in the church is exactly the opposite.
Yeah, when I was talking about the stock market, I agree with you. I mean, if you knew that your money was going to some entrepreneur that you admired and had faith in, I mean, that's a whole other system. That's a system
right.
of, you know, supporting something that's really good. And that makes a tremendous positive change. Whereas on the other hand, if you're, I don't know, investing in something that then turns around and invests in, you know, 50 mega zega galactic corporations that are spraying pesticides all over the world, you know, then what is that for? What's the rationale?
So I have to bring up one of the things I've seen in Europe, and I want to tell you a story. I'm reading a wonderful book on audio while I'm traveling called, it's a history of the American slave trade, but the interesting thing about it is this guy dug in and got out the pricings and figured out all the economics. It's really about how the money worked on the slave trade. And I'm listening to the section where he's talking about how they moved a big portion of the surplus slave population out of the East Coast, out of the Carolinas, and into Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana to build out, you know, they were converting the land to cotton plantations and building out basically a cotton juggernaut, which is really part of what really drove the U.S. onto the economic map in a big way in the global economy. And a lot of it was built on slave labor. Anyway, he's talking about the design of how they're going to migrate all the slaves. And they basically stipulated that 70% had to be single males between the ages of 17 and 36. So as I'm reading this, I jump online. I'm writing a little piece about the refugee migration in Europe. And I look at the EU statistics online, and it turns out 70% of the refugees are single males between the ages of 17 and 36.
Wow. That should tell you what the plan is all about, right?
I looked at it and I said, you know.
Huge economic projects coming right up, right? That need workers.
Well, here's the interesting thing, because now that I've been in Europe for several weeks, what you're seeing is when you see a lot of these folks that I'm seeing, you're talking about young men who've been recruited. You know, they have smartphones, they have new clothes, they have new backpacks, and they feel entitled.
Wow.
They've been recruited.
And I don't know what their orders, instructions are. I assume they're getting them every day through their smartphone. But they bring a confidence that you don't normally see in refugees from war-torn countries. And they are, you know, given the size and the number, they are very intimidating to the local population. And there's no doubt that the local population is absolutely convinced, and I think rightly so, that their culture is specifically being engineered, that their culture is being destroyed intentionally.
Yeah, that, there, to me, there's no doubt about that whatsoever. Absolutely.
Right. And the what I've become convinced of from just from what I've seen so far, if you look at the European population, if you assume, John, that, you know, let's say you have 1 to 5% really governing things, and then you have 20% of the people who really get things done. They're really the people who run the economy and know how to get things done. You know, they're your line managers. They run the infrastructure, whether it's the business bureaucracy or the government bureaucracies and the engineering. They basically run the day-to-day nuts and bolts operations. Those people are deeply angry. They are really angry from the corruption and waste. And I think one of the reasons you see this overwhelming number of refugees is it's a way of directing their anger at something else, and that something else requires them to then need the leadership. So they have to cooperate with the leadership to deal with the refugee situation. And I think there's no doubt about it that part of the raison d'etre for the migration is to keep political control. Because the you know, that you have too many of the people who really make things run getting really frustrated and angry.
Especially in Europe, because if you ever want to spend a surreal afternoon, I could handle it for maybe 2 or 3 hours. I decided to start pouring through EU, European Union documents of the actual governance of Europe by the super bureaucracy. And the council of this and the department of that and what they do and what their responsibilities are and how many regulations are actually passed every day without the population having a clue about it. This was maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I said, oh, I'm just going to take a dip and see what this is like. And I mean, you know, I went stark raving mad in a couple of hours. Because I thought,
right, you're talking about a level of micromanagement which is not operationally feasible.
Completely unfeasible and completely, in a way, untraceable, because you would just get lost in a maze of cards if you tried to figure out how it really operates. So when you said this 20% who is actually running the nuts and bolts of things, you're talking about a whole population of people that are embroiled in that structure. And they go to work every day, and it's like walking into a labyrinth, and they're glad that they even got out to the parking lot to find their way home at the end of the day. So are they angry and frustrated? You bet. And anything that would distract that and keep them, you know, as you say, taking out their frustration in a different way would be a definite political move, because that monster that's taken over Europe is just beyond belief.
Right. Well, it's taken over the Southwest. I mean, you're seeing it in different parts of the Southwest as well. The only thing I will say is if you look at the population coming in the Southwest, you know, it's a much more it's a population that's much more compatible and easily acclimated than the one coming into Europe. I mean, you're talking about a much greater cultural divide. And particularly with a kind of attitude that that the recruited sort of 70% are coming with is, you know, you almost wonder how they're delivering that attitude.
Yeah, I know. It's quite amazing. It's like they all.
I'd love to see the manual behind this one.
Yeah, they all went to the same summer camp, right? And they got the same 6 weeks of here's
well,
how you do it.
Somewhere there's a 2,000-page design book of how they're going to do this.
Yeah.
You know, this was this was very well planned out.
No question
this
about
is,
it.
This is, you know.
Has nothing
this
to
is
do
a major...
with sudden sparking crises here or there or whatever. This is way beyond any of that. It's been in the planning stage for a very long time. I'm quite sure that Obama was clued in, knew all about it from the beginning as soon as he took office, Bush probably as well. It's just, you know, when do we, you know, release it all? When do we start the wave? And we need excuses and provocations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the plan has been there, you know, for a very long time, which is, again, to come back to people changing their minds. This is why I keep coming back to the individual, because, you know, you can see this one of two ways. You can say, well, given the enormous nature of the plan and the structure and the bureaucracy and the people who run things and blah, 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 what can I possibly do as a lone individual? Well, that's the objective, is to get you to think and believe exactly that. On the other hand, you can look at it in a way as liberating. It's sort of like, well, there's all this madness and craziness and perverse theatricality going on so many fronts all the time, and here I am. Well, I don't have to sign up for that. I don't have to enroll in that club and believe what these people believe. And given that fact, you know, I actually have some space to think about things, including what I want to do with my life and what my future should look like as far as I'm concerned. And part of that, of course, is what can I do to make positive change on a larger scale? But it all comes back to the individual, which is,
right,
in a way, a good thing. I mean, that's the way it should be.
Right. Every individual gets a vote
with
yeah.
their, you know, their very being. So
exactly.
One of the things I did do when I wrote up, we had a great presentation on What's Up This Fall 2015, because I got so frustrated by all the fear porn. I said, okay, everybody's got to get grounded around the real dates and the real calendar. And I'm going to show everybody why this fall is a major turning point, you know, but we're going to get grounded in the money and the politics and the real nuts and bolts of what's going on. And, but I did a piece called Shadow Work. There's a guy who wrote a book called Shadow Work about how, you know, technology is being used to lower the price in a way that transfers all the work to us. And so before you know it, we all have 20 hours and 30 hours a week of shadow work that we weren't planning on. But one of the things I tried to do is impress upon people why it is so important who you associate with, all the way from vendors to colleagues to, you know, where you bank, et cetera, because you run the risk of all these institutions sticking you with massive amounts of shadow work. And I think part of navigating the system is really being savvy about protecting your time and, you know, and not putting yourself in a position where your time is stolen. And that's why I think it's so important when you talk about your media time, you know, how are you investing your media time? Are you investing your media time to learn the things you need to, you know, to be more successful at whatever that picture is that you've created to be attracted into? So I'm very concerned that, you know, I keep saying to people, it's really important who you associate with in terms of your bank or any of these other institutions. But part of it is, you know, when you associate with the wrong people, you get hit with lots of shadow time, shadow work.
Yeah, it was a great piece you wrote. And there's so many things, as you detailed in the piece, that people become embroiled in the details of this and that and these forms and this and so on and so forth all the way up and down the line, that at the end of the day, you're just happy to have survived. You know, well, now I can, you know, just sit down and vegetate in front of the TV set because I don't have to do all of this meaningless shadow work that I've been sort of caught up in. And again,
well, that's why, you know, I don't know if you saw what I wrote about autism, but
you know, the thing that really struck me about autism is basically it's the ultimate shadow work. You turn to a mother and you say, you know something, we've just stolen the rest of your life.
Exactly. And, you know, we talked about this about a week ago, and after we hung up, it also occurred to me, yes, you know, you just talk to parents of an autistic kid and you ask them how much time they have to put in just managing the life around this child from the time that a vaccine, say, destroyed that child's life. And it's everything. It's completely everything. And then, as probably a lot of your listeners know, you know, for years I've been writing about the effects of medical drugs on the population and the medical system that in America, for example, at a conservative estimate, kills 225,000 people a year. And the thing that I sometimes do when I write about this, I say, now think about the turmoil that's created around a single death in family, friends, coworkers, you know, people on the fringe who know people who know people who know that person, the settlement of the estate, the emotional suffering and pain that goes on for how long in the wake of a single unnecessary demise from the medical system. I mean, the amount of labor that's taken up in this country alone, you know, could launch a whole other country. If you could just eliminate that alone, you could populate it in the other place and say, we're transferring all these hours of turmoil and suffering because now we know they're not necessary, and we're going to put them, we got this piece of land, you know, called X that we just discovered. It's very nice climate and everything, and a bunch of you people can go there and just start a new country because you'll have the time to do it now because you won't be doing all that medical stuff that's just been destroying your life.
Here's the reality. If you want to solve the medical system problem in America or the educational problem, it's very simple. Cash. Convert them to a cash system. Within 2 years, everything would work miraculously.
Yes,
it would be amazing.
Exactly. Well, this doctor down the block, he just told me he could give me the same thing for $50. And you want to charge me, what was that, $75,000? I think I'm going to go over the, you know, that sort of a system. I mean, everything is legislated against that happening, of course, in the medical front, because they realize that if this were actually a free market, that would mean that you could have all kinds of people chiming in with natural cures and so on and so forth and completely destroy the pharmaceutical companies. But, yeah,
right.
If you reverted to a cash system, then, you know, the medical people would have to adjust what they're charging to the how much money people are willing to pay.
Well, it's funny. One of the things that we have seen in the stock market is the biotech stocks have fallen off tremendously in response to one of the candidates making noises. It was almost as though they realized, uh-oh, you know, at some point, people are going to start really doing the numbers. Boom, market down 30%.
Oh, yeah. That's not surprising to me at all that that happened, because if you go back to the bubble of the 1990s under Clinton, the so-called tech bubble and so forth. At that time, the biotech companies were just really getting rolling, and they were bringing on board scientists and paying them to be shills to go out there and raise investor money and say, look, we're on the verge of this and the horizon of that, and all we need is a little bit more in this, and we're going to be able to just absolutely, you know, take over the world. And, of course, that totally bottomed out because the promises were empty, and it seems like the biotech thing just goes through, you know, one bubble after another that collapses because they're always overstating what they can do. It's just that's endemic to that profession. They don't have much of a leg to stand on. Just look around and try to find, you know, with all the talk about genetics and gene therapy, this and whatever, find a real disease somewhere, that's real, that has a genetic cure all the way across the board. I'm not talking about, oh, we found a case in, Tierra del Fuego last year. No, I mean, where, you know, they just take you into a room and they give you an injection that has something to do with genes and you're cured. You know, and everybody who's got that disease is cured. Just try to find one such disease. With all the talk that goes on about the future of genetic therapy, medically speaking, and you'll see that you can't find anything. You know, it's just lots of blue sky, though.
Well, I don't know, because I've never due diligence these kinds of things, though, or any of the biotech companies the way that you have, but I'm convinced from what I'm seeing in technology that there is a lot of, you know, amazing stuff that's going on. But the reality is it's functioning in a political system which doesn't make sense. And so there's a disconnect between making sense in the marketplace and on the ground and the equity markets. And that's part of what's got everybody nervous.
No question about that.
Right.
If whatever the best of the technology is, you're not going to find it in the places you expect to find it. It's going to be happening off the map somewhere. That's not a company that's, you know, making a stock offering or trying to pump up investments and so on and so forth and announcing what their research prospectus is. It's not going to be anything like that. This would be research, black budget research, off the books, off the map, somewhere where they can do whatever they want to through trial and error, to try to find out how they can re-engineer a human being. And it wouldn't be pretty, and it wouldn't be the kind of thing that they would ever make public.
Right. Well, before we close, there is one thing I wanted to make sure we covered, and I need your help in describing this, and that's because what is, to me, one of the best feelings in the world is when you really do decide to change your mind. When you say, you know something? I'm not going to be a part of the Matrix. I'm simply going to, you know, you can force my body to do so. You know, you can put me in prison, but you can't put my mind there. I change my mind. And when you do it, it's like letting a bird out of the cage. It's the most wonderful, fabulous feeling in the world. And you can't stop laughing because you realize, you know something? I'm free. I'm free and I'm my own person. And nothing and nobody can change that. It's the most marvelous feeling when you, I just came from a workshop on the Pistis Sophia, which is a Gnostic text, where Jesus after the resurrection is ministering to the female disciples. And there's the Pistis Sophia is a female disciple who's constantly set upon by the lower orders of intelligence of this earth, which the text refers to as the archons. And the archons are always getting together and beating her up and dragging her down into a lower mind. And she's constantly trying to, you know, rise to a higher level of consciousness where they can't get her. It's pretty funny. And it's basically the struggle. But when you decide, you know, I don't have to stay in the lower mind, I can simply mentally leave. And now let's see where, you know, that can take me. Let me put my time and money behind that and see where I can go. It's the most marvelous feeling. And what I would love to do is find a way to describe to people how it feels. It's kind of like an inside joke.
Yeah. I'm really glad you brought this up because, and it's a good thing to finish on because it is at the core of everything that we're talking about here. For me, I would have to go back and say, 1962, New York City. And I won't go through the whole rigmarole of how I decided to do exactly what you just said, you know. But the end result was I said to myself, guess what? You're free. And then the feeling of being in this fantastic metropolis, walking down the street in the middle of the afternoon with all of the, you know, chaos, confusion, noise, drama, energy, et cetera, and knowing that I, just walking down the street at the core of that, was completely free, is the most exhilarating thing in the world. You just, you feel as high as the tallest building, and you feel as present as, you know, as you are just standing on the sidewalk. And you know that you can do whatever you want to do. And not only that, but you also know that things you never believed you could do, oh, he doesn't have that talent, and he doesn't know anything about that, and blah, 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 blah. All that is nonsense. Talents come to the fore. Skills show up. Help shows up. People show up. Situations become synchronous. They add to each other. Once you make that realization and you're free, there's nothing like it. It's just incomparable.
It's really funny. Lawrence Ferlinghetti Getty has a poem called Dog.
I know the exact poem.
I can't tell you how much I think about that. I read it to myself when I'm walking down the street feeling free.
The dog trots freely in the street.
The dog trots freely in the street and sees reality, and the things he sees are bigger than himself, and the things he sees are his reality, and it goes on and on and on. It's I'll post it with this
it's a fantastic poem.
The dog trots freely in the street, and he has his own dog's life to live and to think about and to reflect upon, touching and tasting and testing everything, investigating everything without benefit of perjury, a real realist with a real tale to tell and a real tale to tell it with, a real live barking democratic dog engaged in real free enterprise with something to say about ontology, something to say about reality and how to see it and how to hear it.
It's a great poem.
Yep, and
it kind of says it all. Okay, well, John, I'm glad I changed my mind. I have to tell you that after I changed my mind, I was very glad to find you, because you have a ferociousness of intellect that always helps. I don't know, it just always helps keep those walls backed up and keeps my mind, you know, it's there's a lot more space in my mind thanks to your mind.
I'm glad I found you too, believe me.
Oh, well, we're in cahoots and we're just dogs walking down the street. So you have a wonderful, wonderful day, and keep me posted. I can't wait to see what's your next column going to be?
Actually, I don't know if it's posted yet, but it's coming up. It's kind of a fictional interview between a freshman entering college about 20 years in the future and the dean, who tries to clue him in on what it's really all about and how he has to play the game and what the game is now and everything. It's satire, and I think people find it kind of amusing. What the mind has to do in order to, quote, play the game, in other words, not be free, be held prisoner, but somehow, you know, win and control and all of those things. And the dean is quite unhinged and insane. And so it's kind of a funny story.
I just have to mention nomorefakenews.com is John's website. And he has a product called The Matrix Revealed, which includes a lot of the interviews and audio seminars that I always insist that new people coming into the Soliri world, whether you come in as a client or you come in as a subscriber, I always insist that they go off and get all your interviews and listen to some of those early audio seminars, John, because it's simply a way of, you know, they want to change their mind, but they need a lot of insight, and it's a great product. They can get it at the store at No More Fake News, right?
Yeah, they sure can.
Okay, great.
Thank
Anything
you.
Else before we close?
No, I think we just hit it all with that Ferlinghetti poem.
Ha 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 ha! Well, the dog is now going to go trot freely around the streets of Amsterdam, and I'll see you later, John.
It's a deal. Thanks. Love you.